From the Lynn DeGrant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 27th day of March, 2025. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett. He's at agmarket.net. We'll explore early season or pre-emergence herbicide applications with Aaron Hager, University of Illinois Extension Weed Scientist. And then, as we close out our time together, we'll talk about the weather forecast, too. We'll do that with Mike Tenorm at T-Storm Weather, all on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online, on demand, anytime you'd like to listen at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn for the day settled at $4.50, a penny and a quarter lower. July at $4.58, down one. December, new crop, three quarters lower at $4.43¾. May beans at $10.16¾, up 15 and three quarters. November at $10.20½, up 13 and three quarters. Meal, 90 cents higher. Bean oil up $1.57. And soft red winter wheat, three and three quarters lower at $5.47¼. Matt Bennett from agmarket.net now joins us on this Thursday afternoon to take a look at the marketplace. Hello, Matt. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been a busy 24 hours in Washington, D.C. Lots of tariff news there. Did it impact the marketplace at all today?
Yeah, well, the market was pretty dead on the corn side. Actually, beans rallied strongly. You know, I've got to think that a lot of that has to do with just a lot of the talk that, you know, these acreage estimates that are coming in are fairly low on soybeans. And, you know, overall, I think, you know, you've had such a strong corn market versus soybeans for so long, you know, that ratio is probably going to have to come back intact just a little bit. And I think that had a lot to do with some of this buying coming in.
And as you look forward to it, what are you telling producers as it's related to this year's crop in that case?
You know, overall, I think with corn, it just looks rough right now. We've done nothing but slide here lately, broke the 200-day moving average there yesterday on May corn. And, you know, overall, I think a lot of people are frustrated with it, but it is awfully early and we just don't have any weather premium in this corn market whatsoever. Now, if you come in Monday with a huge acreage number, which I think is quite possible, there's no doubt you could have some additional pressure on the market, you know, but are we going to have any weather at all this summer? And I think given world stocks tightening the way that they have, you know, given the U.S. balance sheet likely on the old crop being pretty darn tight, I've got to think that you'll at least have some people a little bit more nervous this summer than what they've been the last couple summers. So right now I'm kind of in a wait and see mode as far as corn goes. Soybeans, I think you've got to consider, you know, with soybeans that if this acreage is low enough, it could finally be some of that support we've been looking for. You know, I'm not saying we're going to rally through the roof necessarily, but we might have an opportunity to get back to some of those levels, you know, that we've seen before, whether it's 10.50 and above, or you know, whether you even get a run at $11 later on, those are all possible. But this early in the year, there's no sense in locking in a loss. So I would just be patient here.
USDA and the Ag Forum put the acreage figure for corn, I believe, at 94 million acres. The agmarket.net number is above that. Remind me of what it is, and then give me the justifications or the evidence that pushes you to the larger figure.
Yeah, we're at 95.39. There's a few things that come to mind. I think as growers were trying to make their decision on acreage, you know, and through the winter time frame, soybean prices have been so poor, if you will. A lot of guys and gals are looking at sub $10 fall cash bids. They're still there today. And so the lack of soybean profits made us feel that you'd really tumble as far as bean acres go. You know, with corn being at 95.39 per us, beans are down at 82.75. And so, you know, you would think that ratio would really work in the favor of corn losing ground to soybeans as far as price goes. You know, and so we did survey everyone within the ag market and JSA world. And so everyone that works with growers directly, you know, contacted their growers to find out, hey, how much are you going to switch around? Are you going to be heavier corn? And we had an overwhelming response for heavier corn acres. So kind of go back to 2 years ago at 94.6 is what we put our baseline at, you know, and then we wanted to work up just a little bit from there, understanding that it is expensive to put this corn crop out. So we didn't want to get super carried away, but we certainly feel like we're going to be above where we're at 2 years ago.
Is it, and you probably have some anecdotal evidence of this because you were surveying so many places within the industry. Is your survey akin to what the old Informa survey used to be as it related to the number of elevators and such that were being contacted?
Yeah, I mean, we contacted a lot of elevators. So, of course, JSA works with hundreds of elevators across the Corn Belt. And so, you know, there's a lot of different touch points that we get. We feel strongly that based upon their feedback to us, you know, that soybeans was going to be a loser, of course, of acres. Cotton would be a loser in the South and in the Delta, you know, and that corn would definitely be a place people might go as far as the Delta's concerned if they can get that in the ground. If they can't, they could gladly plant soybeans. They typically have a much better basis than we do up here. You get over into the Panhandle of Texas and up through the Western Corn Belt, and, you know, basis for corn still stays pretty darn strong. A lot of usage in that part of the world. And so we feel like corn will be the place people will want to place their bets, if you will. But the last thing you got to consider is, of course, crop insurance. Whereas, you know, we're a nickel above where we're at a year ago for spring insurance price, and soybeans a dollar lower than where we're at a year ago. So that safety net, if you will, that a lot of growers rely on pretty heavily, certainly would favor corn winning the day whenever it comes to acres.
You in past years had been an advocate, and I believe so this year too, with the crop insurance to use ECO to a higher number. How are you asking producers to manage that as it's related to their marketing?
Yeah, I think it's definitely one of those things we got to research pretty thoroughly. So this year, of course, you had a little bit more of a subsidy, if you will, to kind of support going that ECO route. I don't have any issue with that whatsoever, but we've been telling our growers, if nothing else, do a lot of research. There's good programs out there that will help you run through the math to tell you whether or not it's a good decision. You know, and so I guess from my vantage point, I've got to think that there's going to be a fair amount of ECO this year. At the same time, I don't know that it's one of those deals that it's a one size fit all either. So again, I just think we got to do a lot of homework. It's expensive to go out there and buy, you know, a decent insurance policy and then add another $15-$20 an acre with ECO. And I understand people being hesitant with that. So again, I just think it's got to be catered to the individual grower.
Yeah. So I was wanting to know, once they've done that, how is it that you included in their marketing plan, and what should they be able to do because they have purchased it?
Yeah. I mean, the problem with ECO, of course, is that it's more of a county policy than what it is, you know, as far as, like, for instance, a revenue protection policy, which is based on your farm's bushels. So it's a little harder to work it into your marketing plan. You know, it's kind of like the old grip policy, but this is just on a portion of your crop. So I don't think that you can take those bushels and say, hey, we're going to be able to know those bushels are going to show up by any means, because if you're the worst part in the county and everyone else has a good crop, you know, then ECO may not pay off very well for you. So it's really hard to use it, in my opinion, as a part of the marketing program.
Okay. And anything else that we need to talk about before I let you go?
No, I just think it's going to be volatile. You know, it's been a rough kind of junky week this week, but next week I think the fireworks could certainly happen. Let's hope that that's not to the downside, because we've lost quite a bit of ground here lately.
We'll look forward to those March 31 Monday reports from USDA. Thanks much, Matt.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
Matt Bennett is with agmarket.net.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media, celebrating 40 years of this program and more than 10,000 episodes. You may listen to it online on demand anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. The theme music for the Closing Market Report is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason.
You know, weeds have been springing up with the warmer weather. It means farmers will need to take care as they finalize their weed control plans. The Extension Weed Scientist from the OVI, Aaron Hager, says producers need to keep track of what's in the field and to understand how each weed grows and reacts to the herbicides being used.
Well, as most people are probably aware, with the recent couple of weeks where we've had some fairly moderate to warm temperatures, a lot of green is now starting to show up in fields. Predominantly, these are many of our winter annual weed species. And it's always a good idea for, you know, folks to try to get all vegetation under control before anything is planted in that field. we always can say, you know, our intention is we're going to plant, we'll take care of controlling the weeds at some point after we plant. But as we typically relearn every year, and that is that the weather really controls what we're able to do. And so those established weeds can actually be fairly competitive with an emerging corn crop or an emerging soybean crop. So trying to get weeds managed before we put any seed in the ground is always a very, very good first step.
To that end, Hager says the utility of a pre-emergent herbicide has increased over time as weeds like water hemp have developed resistance.
We went through an era, of course, back in the late 1990s as the glyphosate-resistant technology came into the marketplace, where we really moved away from utilizing residual herbicides. But given the resistance issues that we now face, predominantly with our water hemp populations in the state, it's really of paramount importance that we use a good foundation herbicide program close to planting time in order to try to reduce the number of, whether again it's giant ragweed or water hemp plants, that we'll have to try to control in the post-emergence application.
Now, glyphosate resistance is one of the biggest issues, and Hager says it is the application rate that really matters.
The application rate is really going to depend on a couple of things. Number one, of course, the spectrum of weeds that you have. Number two, what is the size of those weeds? And then thirdly, what is the particular glyphosate formulation that you're using? So most every herbicide label, especially the ones for the foliar applied products, will have weed sizes on the label. They'll list the species they control and then typically the maximum growth stage at which they can still remain effective. So as we always say, the best information is going to be to read the label.
Hager's been very concerned for the better part of his career about the herbicide resistance within the field crops weed populations. Now, farmers have had some not so nice surprises in recent seasons, and the University of Illinois weed scientist expects he'll be getting some calls about nasty issues again this year.
Well, we're fixing to find out how it works out. It's hard to sit here at this time of year and make a lot of accurate predictions. We can do a lot of guessing, but we'll have to look back about next September and October to see how close we actually were.
You may read more about herbicide resistance and University of Illinois weed science control recommendations in the online agronomy handbook. Search Google for agronomy handbook and look for the Illinois Extension link.
We're now joined by Travis Mateer. He is a beef cattle specialist with the University of Illinois, an extension educator. Thank you, Travis, for being with us. You've written for the Cattle Connection blog an article about including crossbreds, actually crossbreeding, within your herd. And the title was interesting, Cue the Crossbreeding. I'm wondering exactly what that means as it's related to the generally small herd sizes that are in the state of Illinois.
Yeah, I think the purpose of the article was to highlight the advantages of crossbreeding. And really, I just stumbled upon an old ad of hybrid seed corn, and that showed two inbred parents on the outside, and in the middle was that hybrid ear of seed corn. And it was substantially bigger, higher yielding, and obviously a more profitable genetic component. And I thought, man, that's not a new message. But in the beef cattle industry, we've had a huge shift in the last couple of decades towards just predominantly black-hided cattle. And there's nothing wrong with that. We've developed, I think, some really sustainable genetics there, really popular, and genetics that have really been geared towards meeting the meat quality standards that our beef snob type consumers really like. Now, as far as cow-calf profitability and profitability as an industry, we think about, okay, look at that hybrid seed corn, look at our neighbors in the pork and poultry industry and see how they have maternal and terminal lines and they're using crossbreeding at a high level. And now I think the impact that we see of the beef on dairy cross as the percentage of those cattle continue to increase and really replace a high percentage of straight bred Holsteins on the cattle on feed components coming from the dairy industry And it just got me thinking, we need to talk more about crossbreeding for our small beef cow-calf producers. It's easy to always just have one bull, same breed, breeding the same cattle, but we're giving up some advantages there by not including crossbreeding.
So you'll be ruffling some feathers out there at this point, because there are folks who are like, well, I like my Shorthorns, or I like my Angus or Simmental or whatever it happens to be. What are the advantages of having this genetic diversity?
Yeah, and so I guess we still need purebred producers, right? We need to produce those lines, those purebred lines, but on the commercial side and in our commercial industry, I think we need a higher level of crossbreeding occurring. And so my emphasis is, for if you're a commercial producer, if you're a small cow-calf producer that sells feeder calves at the sale barn at weaning, and you're not saving and retaining these genetics for a purebred market, there's opportunity to be had by crossbreeding. And the traits that are lowly heritable and hard to improve, like calf survivability, like cow longevity and cow fertility, those traits are actually the most economically improved by crossbreeding. And so some of those hard things that we're trying to, our best to do on the farm, we could simply do by choosing another good bull in a different breed and crossbreeding. And so that's the emphasis there. Let's utilize good cattle, you know, in each breed, pick the good ones and breed them and crossbreed them.
You know, but because they are small herds, they may say to themselves, but I don't have the money to spend on that kind of genetics on a bull. And certainly I don't have the money to keep trading that bull through for improved genetics across the board. What do they do?
Yeah, I think that's a common thought, but I would ask those producers to look back at their own history and say, okay, well, how often do you trade a bull? And I think they would see that it's fairly often that they are trading in, because those small herds also keep replacements many times. And a lot of times they're culling bulls just because they're keeping daughters of that bull that's there in herd. And so they're probably having turnover anyways. And one thing to think about, if you are a small herd and you want to keep some continuity to your breeds, you can use composite bulls. So there are breeds that have been crossed, and you could, for instance, use like a Simmental Angus cross bull on maybe some crossbred cows, and you're getting a level of hybrid vigor from those different composites. So my personal favorite is the Hereford Angus black baldy cow, and let's put a composite bull on those black baldy cows, and then man, we're really shooting on all cylinders, or firing on all cylinders when it comes to crossbreeding.
Thank you much. I appreciate it, Travis.
Absolutely, Todd. Anytime.
Travis Mateer is an extension educator with the University of Illinois. You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand. Where? At WILLAG.org. And there you can read this article. It is currently on the top of the list at WILLAG.org. Let's turn our attention now to the global growing regions. Mike Tenura is here. He's the president and CEO of T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online. Hello, Mike. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Todd.
Let's begin in South America. Do they have rains in the offing?
Well, they do. That second corn crop in Brazil has been really dry over the last 30 to 40 days. Our data suggests that it was one of the driest, if not the driest, of the last 20 to 30 years for that crop. So they need rain. Now, there has been some since Monday, and we think there will be more going forward. A few cool fronts will move northward, and that will trigger some thunderstorms in different areas. But our concern is that the best rainfall will probably be just to the north of corn areas, as the quasi-monsoon season focuses in that region, and then also a little bit to the south of the key corn areas where the main storm track aligns. So as we move forward, there will be better rains going forward, but will this totally end the dryness story? Probably not. We'll still need to see some pretty good rain starting around April 5th to 10th again.
Can you update us on the Argentine weather forecast too, please?
Well, they're going to turn a lot wetter over the next few days. There's a cool front that's going to move through there as well, and that'll produce significant totals. Now, they were very wet a few weeks ago, then it dried out for 2 weeks. Rains have returned over the last few days, and they're going to keep on going. But after we get through this wet period, it turns real cool and it stays real dry for at least 5 to 10 days, so that will start to improve conditions for harvesting.
Here in the United States, farmers are beginning to scratch the earth, even in the Midwest, but those to the south of us are the ones that really start this early in the spring. What are conditions like for them?
Well, if you look at Texas, it's been fine. They're planting corn and it's been pretty dry, so progress is moving forward pretty nicely. Our concern, though, is what's happening elsewhere. A lot of storm systems are going to move across the central U.S. over the next 2 weeks, and that's going to turn a wide area a lot wetter. Some of the best rains are going to be in the eastern Corn Belt and in the Mid-South, and that Mid-South region is the one that needs to be watched. That is where they start to plant corn and soybeans first. And even though it's a little early here in March to be thinking too hard about it, you know, we're seeing signals that 2 to 4 inches, maybe even 5 or 6 inches of rain is possible over the next couple of weeks. And it's not just that one area might receive that much rain, it's that a wide area is going to see all of this rain. And that's where you start to run into problems, because it's a big volume of water, and that big volume needs to get through the river system and get out to the ocean before things start to dry out. So it is going to be turning a lot wetter through the first week of April in these areas, and we'll have to see what happens after that, because it's going to be at least a wet beginning to the early part of the growing season.
About across Iowa, the Dakotas, into the eastern part of the Corn Belt.
Well, they're certainly going to get some decent rains as well, but the main focus is going to be further to the east. We think that Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and then point south through parts of Kentucky, Tennessee, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Mississippi, those are the main states that are going to have some heavy totals. But the other areas you're asking about are still going to get some good rains, but it might just not be that unusual from a historical standpoint.
In Eastern Europe, the Black Sea area, how are the conditions for crops that are in the ground, wheat that is, in Russia and Ukraine?
Well, they're very dry. The coverage of dryness on these crops is among the highest of the last 5 to 10 years, and we need to see rains as we move forward. Now, we have seen a little bit this week, and it's kind of the same story that we're seeing in Brazil. The rains are scattered around these different areas, and they're going to continue for the next week or two. And so we think conditions are going to improve in at least Russia, where some of the better rains are coming up. As you move westward into Ukraine, the setup isn't quite as good, but they'll still see some rain. But then as you move further west, and now we're in Bulgaria, Romania, Serbia, stretching westward into parts of Hungary, this is the key corn and wheat area, and they're going to see some heavy rain. So it's going to be improving there as well. And this is just going to essentially allow us for more time to figure out how their growing season is going to go, because this will get us through the next couple of weeks, and then we can wait and see what's going to happen in mid-April.
Okay, thank you much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Todd.
Mike Tenura is with T-Storm Weather. That's tstorm.net online, and joined us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online, on demand, anytime you'd like to hear us at willag.org, willag.org. There you'll find our daily agricultural programming, the updated numbers from the USDA when reports are released, along with ways to subscribe to our podcast, and information from the Agricultural Economist, the Crop Scientist, and the Animal Scientist from right here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.